TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
Yanis Varoufakis, Techno-Feudalism and the Death of Capitalism. Stephen Parton interviews Varoufakis on Singularity Radio. Varoufakis defines techno-feudalism and how corporations have appropriated our identity and convinced us to consume things that we neither need nor want, creating environmental destruction. The host of Singularity Radio, Stephen Parton, has focused on how technology is impacting the human condition and society as a whole. Here are excerpts from the original podcast published on September 23rd, 2022, on YouTube. Stephen Parton.
This week, my guest is Yanis Varoufakis, a Greek economist and politician. One thing Yanis is well known for is being the acting Minister of Finance in Greece during their debt crisis in 2015. And since then, he also founded the political party Mira 25, and he now sits in the Greek parliament as a member of that party. Aside from his work in government, Yanis also has extensive experience with the role that technology plays in the economic sphere, which includes researching virtual economies at Valve, which is one of the world's largest gaming companies, and he has even put forth plans for blockchain-based payment systems in Greece. While we certainly discuss some of the larger implications that tech has on economic structures, much of our conversation focuses on his concerns for what Yanis calls techno-feudalism, which he basically describes as the potential death of democratic capitalism at the hands of the tech elite. Everyone, please welcome to the feedback loop, Yanis Varoufakis. So I thought the best place to start before we get too deep into things is just give people a description of what led up to this moment in the world of capitalism and what things are starting to change thanks to technology and the digital world.
2008 is going to prove, I have no doubt about that, a pivotal moment, in the same way that my generation looked at 1929, even though, you know, I was born in 1961, but still, I was born in the shadow of 1929 because the world changed in 1929. Nothing made sense after 1929 in terms that were conventional wisdom before 1929, with the Great Depression, the war economy, the Belt and Road system, the techno structure, as John Kenneth Galbraith put it, in the 1950s and 1960s, it was a different ball game. And I do believe that, you know, in 2008, we experienced my generation's, our generation's 1929, and nothing is ever going to go back to how things were before 2008. So that was at the level of finance, of the macroeconomy. But at the very same time, the technological changes that were already happening, they were happening seamlessly with the digital technologies, the computer, then the internet, Internet 1, well before we got into Internet 2. This continuum of technological change, at some point, like a river, converged with the events of 2008 to produce what I consider to be this great transformation of capitalism into something different, which I like to referred to as techno-feudalism. And to get right to the heart of where I think you would like me to get, I think that the two things have been transformed by technology in capitalism. If you look at the 1950s and 1960s, the rise of the conglomerates of what John Kenneth Galbraith referred to as the techno-structure, the rise of the Uber firm, not Uber, but, you know, the mega firm, and the way in which managerialism took over the large corporations in the United States in particular, two things happened during that period, which were driven by two new service sectors, two new professions. One was Taylorism in the guts of the factory. Mm-hmm. That is the scientific, in inverted commas, organization of production by managers that, you know, studied Taylorist methods, they went, they got their MBAs and so on, So a whole service sector, a whole profession, the purpose of which was to squeeze more productivity out of labor in the factory, on the shop floor, in sales, in the shopping malls, right? So that's one profession. And the second one, I use the Mad Men parable of Don Draper, the advertising executive type, who finds creative ways of commodifying emotions in the advertising sector in order to make us, in order effectively to produce desire that didn't exist. So you have a production process that through Taylorist methods produces things, and a production process that produces, manufactures the desire for the things. So that was happening well before 2008. What technology did was to create a new kind of capital, which lives in the cloud. I call it cloud capital. you can imagine why. Because what it does is it automates these two professions. The Taylorist manager on the shop floor, if you go to an Amazon warehouse, if you go to any factory producing laptops, you'll see that the managerial aspect of the process has been automated. Now it's algorithms that determine the pace of work of Uber workers, of Tesla workers, of Ford motor company workers. And at the very same time, Don Draper has been taken over by an algorithm, a Facebook algorithm, a Google algorithm. So the combination of the financial crisis, which replaced private profit making with central bank minted money, which we still live under, on the one hand, and the technology, which automated and subjected to an algorithm, the Taylorist manager on the shop floor and Don Draper in the advertising industry, this combination effectively did to capitalism that which 1991 did to communism. It effectively dealt a major blow at it, one from which I do not believe that capitalism can ever recover.
And is that what is pushing us into what you call techno-feudalism, where that cloud capital and that automated process has allowed for such a disparity of wealth generation that now we're entering into that feudal state?
Well, yes, because it's not rocket science. I mean, I think it's quite straightforward, because if you think about it, 2008 destroyed one of the two pillars of capitalism, profitability. So up until 2008, even though capitalism underwent many transformations, from Adam Smith's baker, brewer, and butcher, all the way to Thomas Edison, Westinghouse, Ford Motor Company, and so on, General Electric, right? Huge transformation. But nevertheless, profits, private profits, were always, from the 18th century all the way to 2008, were the fuel that ran the system. From 2008 to this day, or to be precise, from 2009 to this day, it's central bank money, it's not profits. There is a complete disconnect between profitability and what drives the system. Mm-hmm. I mean, profits are important, but it's not what drives the system. In other words, there is state power, a very weak state, but nevertheless, that has the power to produce the money, the central bank money that runs the system. And of course, this means huge privileged access to that money by those who have access to the financial sector, because when the Fed prints money, you cannot get that money. It's only, Citibank and Bank of America that can that have access to this money, and they will not give it to you. They will pick up the phone and they will call Apple and they will call General Electric and ExxonMobil and say, do you want some of this money? And those companies will take this money mostly and don't want to invest it in your jobs, my jobs, the jobs of the people who are watching us. They will take it to the stock exchange and buy back their own shares. So this is not capitalism. So that's one thing that really makes a huge change. And the second thing is that, this, what I call cloud capital, has a capacity to, for the first time in the history of capital, to do something quite remarkable, to replenish itself without going through a market. Because think about it. Up until cloud capital was invented, capital was accumulating, replenishing itself, building up within some labor market. So, Henry Ford employed workers. Workers produced cars. Cars were sold. Part of the revenue, or as we left, it's called surplus value, was retained by Henry Ford after having paid his bankers, his rent, all the things he had to pay for. What was left was his profit. Then he invested it, or part of it, to more capital. So capital was reproduced within the factory, within the shop, within the workplace. But now, for the first time, yeah, you and I, whenever we walk around town and we carry our phone with us, you know, we replenish the capital stock of Google Maps. When we post photographs on TikTok or videos on TikTok and photographs on Instagram, we replenish, you know, cloud capital directly without being paid outside the labor market. Markets are being replaced by what most people call platforms. Amazon.com is not a market. It really is not a market. It's a place where you buy and sell stuff, but it is not a market, because if you think about it, the moment you enter Amazon.com, you exit capitalism. It's a bit like stepping out of the building in which you are. Imagine a very third-rate science fiction movie. You step out and you realize that something has happened. And every building belongs to one person. Everything that is sold in all the shops is controlled by the algorithm that is controlled by one person, Jeff Bezos. Right? It's a digital fiefdom. It's not a market. What you see, imagine walking down the street and recognizing that what you see is determined by the algorithm of that one person who decides what you see. If he doesn't want you to see it, you won't see it ever. It doesn't exist for you. You and I are walking down the same street, looking at the same spot, and we see different things depending on what that one person wants us to see. Yeah. This is not capitalism. This is not the market. This is a fiefdom. It's a digital fiefdom. So if you take all those aspects, put them together, right, you have something that I don't think it's capitalism. Now, I mean, we could call it hyper-capitalism if we wanted, right? In the same way that in the end of the 18th century, instead of talking about capitalism, we could say, this is still feudalism, but it is commodified market feudalism. But I think it was important historically to make the break, the conceptual break, because capital has taken over from land as the main source of power. I think similarly, cloud capital is triumphing at the expense of capitalism. It is replacing profitability and is replacing markets. These are the two pillars of capitalism.
How do we reconcile this or solve this? Is this something that needs to be addressed through regulation on capitalism, something like, you know, stopping monopolistic powers from coming to be? A lot of this seems like it was inevitable. So how do we take that inevitable aspect of technology and reconcile it with our desires for democratic capitalism?
I don't think that democratic capitalism is possible. I don't think capitalism is possible. I think capitalism has died. This is a discussion, you know, this conversation, I'm an old lefty, right? It reminds me of conversations that we lefties used to have in 1990 about how can we save communism. We cannot, it's gone. That's it, finished, kaput, it died. Technology and society has overcome all the things that we take for granted. When you say it's inevitable, technology is inevitable because of human curiosity, human creativity. You know, we have a remarkable capacity to produce technological revolutions in spite of ourselves. And that's a good thing. I'm a tech geek. I like technology. But it's not inevitable that technology should evolve the way it has. Let me give you an example, right? I'm old enough to remember Internet One. Internet One in the 1970s, yes, well, okay, it was really very primitive and clunky. And I still remember punching cards in order to interface and sending batch files. There was no email. I'm that old. okay, but still, it was a cooperative enterprise, right? I mean, all the protocols that we still have, I mean, Internet One is still alive. It's there, hidden in our computers, you know. HTTP, for instance, is still part of that original 1970s commons. Internet. It was an internet commons. Nobody had proprietorial rights over it. Take GPS, beautiful technology. It was developed by the Pentagon. And at some point, the Pentagon decided, okay, they will make GPS available to everyone. Or Wi-Fi, for that matter. I don't know whether you know the history of Wi-Fi. It was the result of research at CSIRO, which is the state research laboratories in Australia. So they developed Wi-Fi, the Pentagon developed the GPS, and then they made it available to everyone, right? So you don't have to pay to use GPS. You have direct link, immediately you know where you are on the map. Now, Internet 2, which is based on the appropriation of your identity, your digital identity, by big tech. Now, this is a big thing. It didn't have to happen that way.
Yeah,
it's quite preposterous that you and I do not own our digital identity. Our digital identity is fragmented, and it is owned by different corporations. So if I want to prove who I am, I have to beg my bank to share my digital identity with somebody else who will then know that it's me, or, you know, Facebook, who knows who my friends are, or Spotify, who knows what music I like, or, you know, I do not have all the parts of my digital identity in one wallet, in a private wallet. I don't have that, right? I mean, Web3 promises to do this. I don't think they can deliver it. But this was a political decision. There was nothing inevitable about that. Some really powerful people managed to steal our digital identity from us and to create a huge business in the sense of selling us the right to prove who we are. Now, that is a political decision. It has nothing to do with technological evolution. By the way, I do not believe you can regulate this. You know, it's not like breaking up Standard Oil, which is what Theodore Roosevelt did a century ago. How do you break up Facebook?
Yeah.
I mean, you just can't. I mean, even those who say you take WhatsApp out of Facebook. Well, WhatsApp will simply go bust if you take it out of Facebook because it has no business model, right? it's only there in order to bolster Facebook. Facebook, the whole point about Facebook is that it is unitary. If you break it up, then you kill it, you destroy it. What do you do with Google? How do you, you know? So I do have ideas which are very radical, but they're much more radical than simply regulating.
Let's talk about them. I'd love to hear these radical ideas. Are you talking about ideas that you put forth in your book, Another Now, or are you talking about even more radical ideas?
So imagine a situation where it's like entering college when you enroll and you get a library card. This library card allows you to get books out of the library, to use the computer facilities of the university, to go to concerts, whatever, to vote in student unions, elections, and so on. But you can't sell it. You can't lease it. You cannot leverage it. You have it. And then when you're not in college anymore, you give it back. Mm. It ceases to be valid. Imagine if shares were like that. Imagine the huge transformation of corporations. Yeah. You would still have market-based corporations, but you would not have a stock exchange because, you know, shares would not be tradable. Large companies will decide, let's take General Electric. The owners of General Electric would be the people who work there. You know, suddenly they would want to downsize the company. Either would like, you know, the unit that makes jet engines to spin off to create its own thing, another unit to create its own thing, because it would be much more manageable. And now with digital technologies, it's much easier, much easier, to have shareholders meetings with delegation, with consultation, with deliberation, so that much better decisions can be made by those now new shareholders who are actually the people who know the company best because they work in it. So, you know, if Mark Zuckerberg or Jeff Bezos, who are very smart people, much smarter than I am, you can check their bank account and compare it to mine. If they want to, if they're so smart and the rest of us who work with them and for them and in the company, if we want to take their advice, yeah, of course we can. They would have however to persuade us. At the moment, they don't. At the moment, they simply have a block vote together with institutional investors, which means that whatever they decide goes, mm-hmm. however clever or stupid. You see, this is a quite libertarian, but also left-wing perspective in the sense that you turn companies effectively into cooperatives, you have self-regulation, and you don't have the state meddling with the business. You don't have the senator or the governor or the treasury secretary or whoever, or the president coming to you and telling you, you know, your company is too big, or you should be doing this, you shouldn't be doing that. It happens organically. So, you know, I tell a story of how that could be.
And what do you think the role of other technologies are in this transformation? You mentioned that technology is going to help this transformation now. Do you think it's going to require things like cryptocurrencies, which I know you've been critical of, or artificial intelligence, forms of automation. Are these kind of technological innovations going to be necessary to bring us into that new paradigm that you're talking about in Another Now?
I love artificial intelligence. I'm not critical of artificial intelligence. I'm critical of its uses. Mm. Like, you know, all technologies, you know, you can have from the age of iron. You could use iron to create plows or to, you know, construct beautiful temples like Parthenon, or you can use it in order to kill people, right? So it's not the technology's problem. It's who owns it and what do they use it for? So there are, as you know, there are artificial intelligence programs today, which, you know, are marvels of ingenuity in the sense that they map out the proteins of super bugs that no antibiotic can kill, and they design on their own antibiotics that can kill them. You know, I bow with huge amounts of respect for the people who designed those AI programs, right? But if you use those AI programs in order to create drones that you know, can enter a building, use face recognition, decide whom to kill and whom not to kill autonomously, then I have a problem, right? Yeah. Well, when it's used by, you know, Facebook or Amazon in order to turn people into stupid guinea pigs running on a treadmill, continue to consume things that they neither need nor want, creating environmental destruction, all for the bottom line of Amazon, then I have a problem. It's a question of democratic control of our technologies. And similarly with blockchain, I mean, I think that Bitcoin is a silly idea, but I think that blockchain can be extremely useful when it comes to organizing common ledgers, distributed common ledgers, or when it comes to replacing top-down hierarchical systems of keeping records. So it's a question of how you use the technologies that the present is churning out.
Typically, when people think of cryptocurrencies, they're thinking of third world countries that are able to stand on their own now because they're not using their failing currency, or people, you know, creating an alternative to capitalism. Why is this not true? What is it about cryptocurrencies that fails us?
Because it's not true. It is not. Look at the catastrophe in El Salvador with that idiotic president who adopted Bitcoin. Look, I understand why people hate governments. I understand why they hate central banks. I understand why they hate the exorbitant privilege of the dollar, of the Fed, of the European Central Bank. I mean, I made a career out of fighting the European Central Bank. But folks, there is no escaping political money. Money is and can only be political. If you're a poor El Salvadorian, okay, you have a president who says, okay, Bitcoin is legal tender. Why do you give a damn? Okay, you don't have any, you do not own any Bitcoin. You do not have the capacity to mine it. I mean, who can these days? I mean, it costs the earth to mine anything. Okay, so you need dollars in order to exchange it for Bitcoin. Then your dollar value may go up or down like a yo-yo. This is ridiculous. It doesn't help third world countries at all.
Yeah.
But blockchain is hugely, I mean, it's a solution to a problem we have not discovered yet, or to a series of problems. When I was in the Ministry of Finance, I was planning, because, you know, here in Greece, we are part of the Eurozone, so effectively we have no monetary independence. Essentially, we share a foreign currency, a currency we cannot print. You know, it's crazy, but that's the situation. And we were in the middle of a banking crisis, a financial crisis, an economic crisis. And I was very keen to create additional liquidity and a payment system that would not depend on a foreign central bank centered in Frankfurt. So I was planning, and that's one of the reasons why these people in Brussels and Frankfurt and Berlin hated me with a passion, was because I was planning a payment system that would be based on blockchain, which would be euro-denominated and would be backed by Greek taxes. So there are good things you can do with blockchain. The idea that you're going to replace money with a pie-in-the-sky, apolitical, gold-like, you know, digital thing, that is a dangerous fantasy.
What are your thoughts on something like basic income as we look forward? Is that something that technology can help us create?
I'm on record supporting UBI on one condition, that it is not financed through taxation. Because you know, if you go to a blue collar worker somewhere in Indiana or Minnesota, and you say to them, okay, you're killing yourself working in a factory, in a warehouse, Walmart, wherever you are working, and we're going to take a cut of your money in the form of federal or state tax, and we're going to pay people to do nothing and watch television, or rich people for that matter, you've lost them. They will look at you as a public enemy number one, rightly so, right? So I don't believe in tax-funded basic income, but I believe in a crypto digital currency issued by the Fed in your country, the ECB here in Europe, the Bank of Japan. Imagine if we all had a digital wallet with a central, which can happen tomorrow, by the way, right? Technologically, it is really very easy, extremely exceptional. We all had a digital wallet that allows to trade with one another for free. No bank fees, flat, horizontally. Same to everybody. That's a basic income. And by adjusting it up or down, you can actually control for the rates of inflation a lot more effectively than what the Fed does. Because think about it, you know, today we have a problem with inflation, but up until a year ago, we had a problem with deflation. You know, the Fed in the United States, the ECB in Europe, they were struggling to create inflation, they couldn't. They were printing and printing and printing as if there's no tomorrow, and there was no inflation, okay? Why? Because it was going all through, the printed money was given to Wall Street. Wall Street was channeling it to the financial sector. You had asset price inflation, nothing, you know, no stimulation of the economy. Now you have the opposite. You have too much inflation, right? And the Fed doesn't know what to do about it. You know, if they increase interest rates to 3-4%, then half of the world's going to go bankrupt, the ones who have borrowed in US dollars. And then that would create a huge recession, which is going, you know, is going to sting the United States.
Yeah.
If we all had digital wallets in our jurisdiction, then the basic income could adjust, you know, go up and down in order to control for prices much more effectively and provide a basic income. So the technology is a problem, but it's also the solution.
You heard excerpts from a conversation with Yanis Varoufakis, the Greek economist and politician. He was the acting Minister of Finance in Greece during the debt crisis in 2015. Thanks to Stephen Parton, the host of Feedback Loop on Singularity Radio. Listen to the full conversation on YouTube under Techno-Feudalism and the Death of Capitalism. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, TUCradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.